Thanks everybody for coming. It's part of a small crew, but that's all right. This is going to be really interesting. I did a story sometime last year about Monsanto moving kind of into providing data services for farmers, and it got me really thinking about the ways in which the ag system is kind of relying more and more on, you know, innovative kinds of software and hardware, and how farmers are kind of integrating that into what they do, and the ways in which that can contribute to climate change adaptation, and also to conserving natural resources, using less, you know, pesticides and fertilizer and other things. So I wanted to have a chat today about sort of where this is going, what are the trends that are happening, you know, kind of what are the kind of issues we're bearing in mind as we like develop this industry. Have a really awesome panel of people who have been willing to join us. So to my left here, we have Eric Andrico from, am I saying that right?
Your last name?
Yeah. He's the Vice President of Science from Climate Corporation. And we have Kristen Weeks Duncanson, who asked me to introduce her as a farm wife with an attitude from southern Minnesota, slash farmer, slash producer, who has been an early adopter of this kind of technology. And then also Robert Parkhurst from the Environmental Defense Fund, who is their director of agricultural greenhouse gas markets. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I might just ask the panelists first to, I think we're just going to have kind of a free-flowing conversation rather than doing sort of lengthy you know, presentations or anything like that. But, you know, I think just to kind of introduce maybe, you know, besides your name and title, maybe I might just go down the line and ask people to, you know, just introduce yourselves to us and tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so like, thanks for the introduction. My name is Eric. I lead the data science activities, in particular at the Climate Corporation. And the Climate Corporation was originally founded to help businesses around the world adapt to climate change. That was our founding mission. And we very quickly recognized that there is one group of people who are at the forefront of climate change adaption, climate change risk, and in fact, the same group of people seem to always be talking about the weather, and that is farmers. And so we're very focused on the agricultural world today. And we provide information tools to turn farmers from being data-rich to being information-rich. These are tools that provide personalized insights that can be used day-to-day on the farm to help make important decisions, decisions like which of my fields are at risk of having fungal or other diseases, to how much fertilizer should I apply to maximize the efficiency of my fertilizer spend, for example. And we see information technology, big data, if you want to use that buzzword, data science, in terms of integrating information together from multiple sources and turning that into actionable insights, has really been at an important confluence of a couple of different trends. So if you look worldwide, we're seeing population increases around the world. We're seeing increased per capita consumption of agricultural products at the same time. And if you believe estimates that come out of places like the FAO, we expect to see agricultural yield shortfalls with respect to demand by 2050 in the order of 60%. So if you're in the developed world and you can afford a slightly larger food bill, that's probably not a big problem. If you're not so fortunate, it maybe is a bigger problem. And we see the opportunities provided by the technologies we have at processing and integrating mass amounts of data together and turning that data into useful information and recommendations can help drive increased yields and at the same time help more efficiently use resources.
As introduced, I am a producer owner of a farm, family of diversified farm in southern Minnesota. We raise corn, soybeans, hogs, canning peas, children, pumpkins, whatever there is to raise, we raise them. Anyway, and I will dare say that we are early adopters at our farm, on our farm, with data and trying to weed through the huge amount of opportunities there are with data. One of the questions we would have about that is, how do we critically assess the outcomes we desire to move our business forward, and how do we choose? And then finding ways to integrate some of the things that Eric was talking about with our financials, with our conservation, with crop insurance. So we've been involved with lots of different practices and lots of different opportunities on our farm. I've also been involved with the Agri Project and also with CAECO ISM and sustainability. And all of it really comes down to managing data, getting producers to figure out, what do I need to know? How can I use this? How do I move ourselves forward? And then how does what I do on my farm make constant improvements if it's a conservation practice? And then take all of that and become more friendly or more appealing to the supply chain, which is our customer. So we grapple with data on, in some respects, on how to choose and what to choose, but we relish in the fact that it's at our fingertips and it becomes a very valuable tool. And I'll just leave it at that, and then we can hopefully have a good exchange.
So I'm Robert Parkhurst. I direct EDF's Agriculture Greenhouse Gas Markets Program, and I kind of wear two hats in my role. One of it is that I try to find ways to pay farmers and ranchers for doing practices that demonstrate environmental benefit, decrease greenhouse gas emissions, improve water quality. But I also look at it from our larger sustainable ag perspective of how do we get the supply chain to move forward to implement practices and to optimize their fertilizer use. And so about 10 years ago now, Walmart made a pledge that they were going to reduce 20 million metric tons out of their supply chain. So not out of their operations, not out of their suppliers' operations, it's further downstream. And they came to this number, when they started looking at this number, they said, well, where is the biggest impact in our supply chain? And it was the fertilizer that's applied to the crops that end up in the products on their shelves. So the vast majority, that's the largest wedge they found in it. And so they said, well, we're going to reduce that. And so they set a goal to do that. And in typical Walmart fashion, they set the goal and they said, okay, now how are we going to meet it? And so they turned to us and we started working with the supply chain to try to figure out how they could do that and helping the design the systems and design the processes to do that. And we're thrilled to say now that we have a tremendous commitments from companies across the supply chain to implement these practices. But to both do this in the supply chain and to do things for environmental markets, we need the data. We need to be able to show that these practices are actually happening. We need to be able to measure how much of a reduction they have. And we need to do it using big data sets and the latest science. That's what's really exciting to us. And we sit at this point right now, and I like Eric, am located on the left coast, right near Silicon Valley, and see this tremendous change. In 2014, there were 264 deals totaling $2.36 billion of venture capital into agriculture technology. First half of 2015, there were already 228 deals and just over $2 billion. So there's tremendous, tremendous excitement in this. Just a couple months ago at the TechCrunch Disrupt Conference, a company called AgriList won the prize. Now, it was a measly $50,000, but this is the first time an agriculture-related company had won the prize. I'll give you a couple of names of companies that won it in the past. Mint, which was acquired by Intuit in 2009 for $170 million. Yammer, which is an instant messaging app, acquired in 2012 by Microsoft, $1.2 billion. And Dropbox, which is now valued at $10 billion. So what we're seeing is this tremendous opportunity. We sit at this point that it's just tremendously exciting for me to figure out how we can use that technology, that knowledge, to create environmental benefit.
Robert, I might ask you to follow up on that a little bit. I mean, so when we're talking about sort of this concept of precision agriculture, can you give us more of a detailed sense of, you know, what types of data are we looking at exactly, and how does that kind of feed into climate, adapting to climate change for farmers and also conserving resources. So walk us through the kind of steps there.
Sure. I see it that there are really, and Eric can add to this, I'm sure, is that there are two main places of data sets. There's the on-farm and the off-farm data set. So you've got the on-farm data set, which is like planting date, what seeds you use, planting depth, harvest date, and yield. And then you have the off-farm information, which are things like the weather and the precipitation and things of that nature. And both those data sets are critical to be able to measure the environmental benefit. If we look at it from a fertilizer perspective, you know, it is the soil type, it is the precipitation, it is the temperature that are the biggest drivers of causing nitrous oxide. And so we need to be able to find ways of pulling all of that data together in a way that we can measure the environmental benefit. And we also have to do that in a way that is that works with businesses like Kristen's. And you know, there has been an unfortunate history, some of it from the environmental industry, of taking a lot of this data and using it in ways that, and some of them embarrass growers. And so EDF is a market-driven organization. We believe that we need to send the signals and we need to drive the right behavior. We don't believe in the shaming method because we think that's more effective. And if we're going to be successful in this, we've got to find a way to do that in a way that people like Kristen and her peers are going to adopt.
If I could just follow up, and the promise of doing that as it relates to doing two things for production ag is that we're always looking for opportunities to increase productivity, not just profitability. Profitability is my responsibility as a farmer. Productivity is the community's responsibility, or not responsibility, but response. And then mitigate risk. So we're mitigating risk in lots of different ways for, you know, getting a crop all the time. Doing it in an environmentally enhanced way, so we're leaving soil healthier, and then also mitigating risk because we have a constant place to sell to. So the promise of doing this data, the tricky part is for producers is trying to decide which data to use and which programs to participate in. And then it has to overlay, we were talking earlier, overlay on your financials. Because that's what helps us make decisions. So it's navigating that is the next step in trying to pull up all together. And it has to be simple. It's got to be user-friendly. Chris and I were having a conversation this morning about a project he saw that was really easy, color-coded, of when you go home and cut your hay. So it's making things much more integrated, simple, easier to use, because as you all know, there's only so many hours in the day, and right now at our house those days are 24 hours long. There's no sleeping because it's harvest. So it's those kind of issues that are not impossible to handle, but are getting there. If Mary Kay were here today, she'd be wanting to talk more about the privacy issue of that. We can overcome that. We did that in the medical industry with your privacy when you go to the doctor.
And we will come back to that, definitely.
Okay.
That's an interesting part of it. Eric, could you tell us a little bit about what's an example of some of the products that Climate Corporation is rolling out, software and hardware, et cetera, that are, you know, getting at some of these goals that Kristen was just talking about? And also, I'd love if you could also add to what Robert was saying about the rate of adoption and what you guys are seeing as far as that trend.
So just to follow up a little bit, I think this theme of integration is really kind of the right idea. And I think integrating data together, and this can be data from the farm or off the farm, is certainly absolutely important and vital to that. But it's also integration in terms of the delivery. Mm-hmm. The data by itself is nice to have if you're a nerd like me. You love looking at the data anyways, and you're happy with that. But I recognize that not everyone wants to be spending all their time analyzing data. People have other things they would prefer doing. And so integrating that data together and providing a bridge to actual insights and recommendations is an important step. And then integrating into the actual operations of the farm is vital as well. Because if it doesn't connect to the equipment in terms of getting the data into the system, or doesn't connect to the equipment in terms of getting the action out of the system, it's not going to be as effective. And that's the way that we think about it. And just to give you an example, of some of the products that we have. One thing that I'd like to talk about is something that we have to help manage fertilizer more efficiently. We have a tool that integrates all these data sets together. Data that comes, the important data you mentioned from on the farm, comes directly from the planter itself into our platform. And that's combined with data sets from the National Weather Service, our own weather models, a wide variety of different data sets that tell us information about the soil, about the atmosphere, and what the farmer practice is, that all need to be integrated together because they interact in how they impact decisions with respect to fertilizer, making optimal fertilizer decisions. And then we provide a tool that allows growers to estimate outcomes under different types of practices, things that they can control. They can apply fertilizer in the fall. You said you didn't do that.
No, we don't.
Or they could apply it in the spring. And there's a big difference in the amount of fertilizer that ends up in the crop versus the amount of fertilizer that ends up in the Gulf of Mexico, depending on which of those two practices you take, for example. And it all is boils down to an interaction of the soil and the atmosphere and the practices at the end of the day. And we try to make that understanding as accessible and as integrated into the farming operation as we can. And we've seen that the farmers that we talk to, in the interesting hearer perspective, are very hungry for this technology. I've never heard a farmer tell me, "I wish I was less informed. I wish I could make less optimal decisions. I wish I could overspend on fertilizer," as an example.
Yeah.
Never heard that said. Maybe I'm not talking to the right farmers. I don't know. And we've seen tremendous adoption of our platform and also tremendous interest in the industry in terms of a level of investment that just shows the potential. Right now we have about 75 million acres on our platform, primarily corn and soybean acres in the Midwest in particular. And we've been very happy seeing the farmers adopt our products and beginning to see some very interesting impacts in terms of actual productivity improvements and efficiency.
But what has been your rate of adoption? Like, how many people are using the climate app, for example, or how has this kind of been growing over the last few years?
Yeah, we've been very pleasantly surprised with the rate of adoption. I mean, I have heard some people liken this to the exponential rate of adoption in the early biotech era, in terms of going from no growers using this technology to massive numbers of growers using this technology very quickly. I think we've exceeded our estimates of what we expected to see adoption at least twofold. We're on more than 45% of acres for corn and soybeans today. That number goes up and up day by day. And so we're very excited to see the level of interest. And I think we're very excited to continue to bring interesting products onto that platform and ultimately make it easier for everyone to be able to get the insights they want from the data they provide and make it seamlessly connected to the other data sets that matter.
Mm-hmm. Robert, I wonder if you could talk. I know you do some work on like emissions trading for ag and that kind of thing. I wonder if you could talk about how these kind of farmer decision making that's informed by the kind of data that we're talking about, how does that interact with sort of other efforts that are happening at the state level or elsewhere to kind of reduce the carbon footprint of farming
So in order to have anything in a market, you have to have some certainty over what you've got, and so you need to have a strong model to figure out what your reductions are. And so there are a number of different models that we've used to measure both methane and nitrous oxide to be able to quantify that reduction and be able to turn it into something that is commoditizable into an environmental market. And just the quick example of that was that on June 25th of this year, the California Air Resources Board adopted a protocol for for offsets from rice cultivation. This is the first time a crop-based practice was adopted by a cap-and-trade program. And so now rice growers across the U.S. can implement practices that reduce methane generation and sell those reductions to compliance entities in California. And to do that, you've got to have good data sets. You have to know what your soil is. You have to know the weather is over time. You have to know what your plant date is. You have to know what your harvest date. You have to know... You have, and to go even further than that, for those markets, you have to be able to prove it. So you need to be able to show your seed receipts, for example, to show that you whether or not you've dry seeded or wet seeded your crop. You need to be able to show what date you actually harvested. And some of that you can do through a lot of the technologies that are out there, things like ClimateCorp technology. Other things you can do with remote sensing. You know, we've been able to demonstrate with 93% accuracy whether or not someone has dry seeded, for example. So those are the type of things that you need to do. And as these markets expand, the demand is going to increase as well. And hopefully, the complexity will decrease in that at the same time, meaning that it will be easier for people to collect the records that are now in paper form, and if you're lucky, in spreadsheet form, to be able to access these markets.
Kristen, I wonder if you mentioned before that some of the challenges as far as trying to figure out what kind of data you should be looking at, how to look at it, and also you mentioned the this concern of wanting to make sure that any data that you share with a third party is kept proprietary. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit just about those challenges. I mean, as you've gone about adopting this stuff, putting it into practice, what kinds of obstacles have you run into or challenges overcome or lessons learned, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a difference between what we do on our farm and kind of my neighbors. We have the belief that if someone really wants to see your data, even with the greatest privacy out there, it's out there. And there's a benefit to sharing. Aggregation is power, as we believe. But I think that other producers maybe are still a little gun-shy over some of the other, as Robert alluded to it earlier, of what that means for privacy and sharing, because it could eventually be more regulatory reform as government and consumers want to know more. There's a little hesitation by producers to know what that really means and what is it really they know about me and how is this going to benefit. So I think the challenges have been that the track record has left people a little skeptical out there. And
Have there been like cases of that kind of thing happening?
Well, it's back to the days when EWG released all the benefits that producers were getting from farm payments. That still is a hangover, and I know that sounds kind of sophomoric, but it is. And then just the idea too of that big company overhang kind of thing, and then the regulatory issue. If people know that this standpipe in my field needs fixing, will I be paying a large fine? It's that kind of thing. And that was a simple explanation. So it's getting over some of those kind of challenges. And as many farmers that you have are super progressive, you've got an equal or even greater bunch that isn't. So it's marrying those things and making sure that you realize what opportunity it is. And, it's back to that critical look at your business to say, this is how I want to operate, and these are the opportunities that I have. So it's a more of a cultural mind shift sometimes than it is a practical reality of what's out there. And it's back to the integration, too. You have to be able to have all the things you're going to work with integrate before you get a massive adoption. Yeah.
Please?
Yeah, go.
I'm curious about, we've heard a lot about kind of the age of farmers and the average age. And as we were talking about tech, I just wonder,
it's a huge challenge.
Do you bring your grandkids with you when you go and talk to some of these to get them to adopt your work?
Yeah. And that's very true. That's very true. My nephews who farm with us are much more adaptable than I am, and my son, who's 19 and a student at the university, frequently gets a call to say, I can't fix this. And it's that kind of thing, too. There's an age gap there. It's just some of us that are in this middle age thing are slower to adapt. That goes with everything.
I wonder if there are other farmers that are aging.
Oh, yeah, and they throw their, ask Chris, they just throw their hands up and say, I'm just going to hope this goes away.
is that something that you've encountered? I mean, is there like a learning curve, you think, for people that you're targeting as customers, trying to, sell them on the idea that it's worth, it's worth their kind of time to figure this stuff out?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, what we've seen is a couple of different things in this area. So one is that a large number of farmers we've seen have kind of skipped over the PC era, mm-hmm. and they kind of went straight to mobile phones. They're on the go yeah. anyways. And we find a tremendous amount of mobile device adoption, tablet, smartphone adoption amongst farmers. And so that's kind of created, I think, a nice inroads in terms of being able to deliver technology on the go very, very easily. And we find that those devices have to be pretty easy to use. There is some segment of the community that is really just not interested in these types of technologies, but we find that that is, tends to be a pretty small segment. It's not, by and large, not the majority. And we don't see that it is perfectly correlated with age either. I think we see different attitudes towards technology in different age groups.
Yeah, I'd agree with that comment about going right to handhelds. It's that technology has been great, and people have done it. A couple of managing your physical inventory on an iPad is genius. To know when you dump that corn in this building, how many bushels went in and what percentage moisture it went in and what the down to the protein is in there. And then when you haul it out, that was genius, and that skipped over. So a very good observation from a marketing point of view. Way to go, guys.
Well, it's also about just making things really easy to use. I mean, I think sometimes people focus a lot on the technology itself and think that technology is really good and that will lead to adoption. But I think in general, it's not enough to have really good technology. It needs to be integrated and needs to be easy to use. And you know, one farmer, I remember him telling me that there's a 20-minute rule. You got 20 minutes to explain how the technology works and that I can figure it out because I have to go do something else. And if I don't figure it out in 20 minutes, then forget about it. Maybe next year we can talk again. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that. 20 minutes is exactly the amount of time. Yeah, same goes true with the TV remote, though. So it's not just, it's just not on-farm production tools. It's everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Robert, anything else that you want to add about you know, kind of helping to sell farmers on this, or getting people to adopt it more, or you know, kind of overcoming some of the challenges that we've talked about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting that one of the biggest challenges that we hear in doing this, and you know, we've talked a lot about it, is the privacy side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to underestimate that at all, and Kristen alluded to it as well, is that it is a very solvable problem, and we have to be able to solve it solve it.
Just for people in the audience who maybe aren't totally clear on what that issue is. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you mean by the privacy.
Yeah, so farmers are really concerned about their practices being made public. They and in particular yield, is that a lot of them don't want their yield. They don't want how much fertilizer that they use. They don't want their plant date to be, because a lot of that is, there's two concerns. Kristen mentioned one is the potential for regulation, but some of it's their competitive advantage.
Mm-hmm.
It's how they're actually running their business. So I, and the thing to me is that this is completely solvable. We've done it in other ways, and from my perspective, there's three ways we could go about doing it. One, you could do it from a government regulation perspective. You know, and some of that was started in the 2008 Farm Bill, and that's a good start. You could go further with it. You could do something like HIPAA, where you know, if you've got more than 500 people affected by disclosure of health data, you need to send it to Health and Human Services, make it to the media, and to the people that are impacted. Another way you could go about it is that you could go and you could do it via a trade group. You know, you could have an organization out there, and this is a little bit, you know, it's too bad Mary Kay isn't here, but that's a little bit of what the American Farm Bureau did, is that they sat down with Climate Corp and John Deere and other companies and established a data standard on that. And then a third way is that you could have a company whose business it is relies on the data. You know, there's lots of companies that are like that, that their sole business is the data. They don't do anything else. And if they don't handle the privacy, they're out of business. And so you've got companies like Farm Mobile or Farmers Business Network or Granular that, you know what, if they don't protect your privacy, you'd stop using them.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd walk away, and they're done.
Right. Yeah. Eric, this seems like something that Climate Corporation has figured out, has been quite clear about with customers about what to expect on the privacy front.
Yeah, we have take data privacy very seriously, and we have developed what we think is the best, if not one of the best, privacy policies in the industry, in partnership with talking to growers and in partnership with associations like American Farm Bureau, as an example. And it's pretty simple. We make the policy easy to understand. Farmers can understand what it says. We believe that it's their data, not anyone else's data. We believe that they get to decide how the data is used, and they get to decide or delete the data if they don't want to have the data involved anymore. And just to build on that a little bit, I think in my experience in talking to farmers, I recognize there's lots of concerns about data privacy that tend to be more abstract concerns or concerns of the form you mentioned. But then when you talk to them about something very specific, like, for example, you tell them that you have an information product that will help them make more informed fertilizer decisions, and then you say, well, to make this tool very personalized to your field, we want to know what soil type you have in your field. Well, of course you do. If you didn't ask me for my soil type, I wouldn't believe it. And then we say, well, it's important to know when you planted your crop. And then they will say, well, of course you do, because if you didn't ask me when I planted, I wouldn't believe the information the tool provided. So when it's very specific and they see very tangible value from it, mm-hmm. and it makes a lot of sense how it's going to be used, then they become very interested. And as we've seen when we look at the market, even across these different market segments and different generations, like we mentioned before, there's definitely a willingness to provide data when it's well understood how it will be used, it's well understood who owns it, and it's well understood what the benefit will be ultimately on the farm.
Do you have, sorry to take your thunder here, do you have a feel for how many people are opting out of deleting the data, of taking that option?
I don't have exact numbers, but it's most people are, like I said, are in that camp where they know how it's going to be used, they recognize
and
the
so
value
it
brings, and so
kind of changing gears somewhat, Eric, but taking a kind of big picture view. When it was in early 2014 or 2013, when was it that Monsanto acquired?
It was at the end of 2013.
Okay. I wonder if you could just kind of describe what ClimateCorp's relationship with Monsanto is, and also kind of generally, is there a kind of trend happening where, you know, the kind of big ag companies like that are increasingly starting to look more and more like tech companies, or, you know, kind of merging into the sort of, you know, what we would associate with Google and Facebook kind of territory? How much is that really happening?
Yeah, I think there's a general interest or recognition of being at this inflection point in the use of data to help worldwide food production from a sustainability perspective, from a productivity perspective, from a distribution perspective. There's a variety of ways in which you can think about food production being impacted by the technology, and especially the data technologies that are available. And I think, you know, Monsanto is really a leader in terms of thinking, being forward-thinking with respect to adopting these technologies and thinking about how these technologies can be integrated and used to leverage or to multiply the effect of technologies that are already out there. And so it's been a really interesting partnership and a very productive partnership since then, and I think we're really excited to be working with a partner like Monsanto and, mm-hmm. and bringing this revolution to farmers like we have here today.
Is this something that you see other kind of ag companies are also moving in this direction as well in a big way?
Yeah, I think we're starting to see that. I think by and large, Monsanto and Climate are probably the furthest along. But as was mentioned in the beginning, there's lots of investment and lots of interest in the space. So I don't think we've seen the end of things here. I think we'll continue to see investments, and I think that's just a reflection of the tremendous opportunity we have at really providing these integrated solutions that can be used to maximize for outcomes for the environment, for the individual farmer, and for mm-hmm. society as a whole.
I think it's important to keep in mind that it's not an either or when you're choosing your suppliers. A lot of times you use suppliers. It's an and. So as you look at what you're going to plant or what you're going to use as inputs, it's not like you join one camp, the Monsanto camp or the Syngenta camp. It's a plethora of folks that you're going to work with based on your business model. What's your soil type? What's your desired outcome? Who's your market? Those kind of things. And and in agriculture, as these guys well know, it's your relationship too. There's a very, very human element to how you operate. Yeah. So that the ease of using the product is also a huge factor.
Sure, sure.
To say nothing of cost, but yeah.
Robert, maybe we could kind of start to look forward a little bit. I mean, what do you see as the kind of next, what's next on this field? What are the sort of immediate challenges that need to be addressed in this way?
Now? Well, I think the key is, and Eric hinted at this, is the user interface. I mean, we've got to make it so that it's really natural, it's really easy to collect that data. And then taking the next step from that is interoperability, is that, you know, the American Farm Bureau estimates that 80% of all data stays on the tractor. And you know, there are some companies that still have a proprietary format for their data. If we're going to get that data into a way that is usable back to the farmer, we've got to find a way so that it can get exchanged in a really easy and seamless way. And that's kind of those are the two main steps, is one, make it really easy to use, and two, get it so that it doesn't matter where that data is, it can move from one device to another and back again, so that you can get that value out of it.
Mm-hmm. Eric, what are you guys cooking up on that front? What's the next thing for you guys?
Well, in terms of some of the interoperability, we, shortly after we were acquired, we actually were one of the founding members of the Open Ag Data Alliance, because we recognize that the data is going to be valuable to the extent that it can be applied in different ways and can move seamlessly. I mean, one thing that we're have on the horizon, the near-term horizon, to try to really make the experience as easy as possible for the grower is we have a new product that plugs directly into the tractor that allows for seamless data integration from the cab to the cloud, and allows the farmer to be in the cab, focusing on making management decisions and planning for the coming season or the next season, and spending less time taking thumb drives in and out of the cab and uploading data and transforming formats when they could be within them.
Cab to cloud.
Cab to cloud.
No more dropping the thumb drive in the truck as
no
it
more.
Goes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thumb drive up the auger.
That's the secret challenge that we haven't talked about yet. It's just dropping the thing in the dirt. Okay.
Yeah, and watching it go up the auger into the truck. Happens.
One other thing I wanted to talk about, and then I don't have too many more questions, but maybe take some more from the audience if there are any. But one other thing I wanted to make sure we addressed was looking beyond our own borders. You know, what opportunities exist for this type of kind of precision agriculture? And maybe, you know, it's not going to be the exact same things. You know, not everybody in India has an iPhone, right? But looking beyond our borders, you know, how can we apply this to the kind of broader issue of food insecurity in the developing world? What are some of the lessons we could take from the U.S. and apply to less developed agricultural markets? I'm happy to give anybody's thoughts on that.
It's funny you mention India, because actually we do have an information product, a decision support tool in India. It doesn't work on a smartphone. It works by text message or phone call.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of these precision agriculture technologies are very readily adaptable to different agricultural markets. Everything from a U.S. market to a smallholder producer in Africa. I think India is a good example of that, where there's still a need to have access to information seamlessly. The types of information may be different, but ultimately it's about empowering the farmer through information. And in smallholder cases, there may even be opportunities, and these are some things that I've seen with organizations like the World Bank, and something that we've had experience in the past, and that is providing insurance products, scalable insurance products. You mentioned use remote sensing before, but one can provide for some risk products in the form of insurance products that scale very well by using these types of technologies to understand what happens in terms of the impact of weather on yield in a scalable way that then allows for farmers to use that insurance policy to get access to credit markets, which allows them to buy more inputs, have higher yields. So in some ways it provides step changes in addition to the direct information products.
I really think as we build capacity for the world to feed itself, technology and this kind of which is what Eric described, is really the key to doing that. And also not only on the insurance side, but also on food waste, on post-harvest waste is an important way to monitor what's going in that bin, how long, what's the condition of it, do we need to put air in there, do we need to move it, that kind of thing. I mean, there's amazing statistics on post-harvest waste in Africa, and the technology advancements that we've made are going to help with that capacity for the world to feed itself. We have to get over this mentality that we're going to put everything on a ship and send it somewhere to a customer. That's just not going to happen. So this is probably the brightest opportunity that I see for food security around the world.
We've seen the same thing in our work in India. I'll echo what Eric says. We're working with thousands of farmers there, implementing practices on individual rice paddies of trying to reduce methane. And the real challenge there is you have to scale, because in the U.S. you're talking hundreds and thousands, and in some cases tens of thousands of acres that people are working on. In India, you're talking about acre or less. Mm-hmm. And so the technology has to be really easy to use. It's not even at the smartphone level. And my colleagues in India, they work with a farmer and they say, can you type in the number that I need to go to? Because it has to be super, super simple for them to do. And I applaud Eric for their work on doing it with text messaging, because that's the way that we've got to start. Because that you can move people very quickly that way if you make it really simple.
One thing I wanted to ask too about this, I guess, is there any concern that the products, and I guess this applies to the developing world, but also like in some ways to the U.S. By offering these products that give such a clear advantageous edge to the people that use them, but does this kind of advantage farmers who are able to afford these technologies? I mean, if you're a farmer in India, you can't afford a cell phone. Does this kind of create a new division between big and small farmers in any way? Is that a concern at all?
I think one thing to think about with respect to mobile adoption is that even in the developing world, mobile adoption rates are very, very high. Mm-hmm. And talking about talk about farmers skipping the PC generation, but we see that as well as in the developing world. And so it seems like the access to technology, there are pretty low barriers to access to technology today.
I have to tell my sick pig in China story. I had the opportunity to go to China to a very remote farming village that had not seen Americans before. And there was a farm family there. We were there with a translator from Foreign Ag Service and meeting with a family who had a sick pig. And this pig was the basis of their operation. I mean, the corn they raised, the manure, the whole thing. And the pig was ill. And through the translator, we heard that the veterinarian was on the way. And they had no telephones, no landlines. I said, how did this happen? Well, I just took a picture of my sick pig and sent it to the veterinarian. So, I think that there's an opportunity there for people to make that investment. And in that particular village, the village itself helped make that invention for the cell phone to get to the veterinarian. So there's those kind of opportunities all over. And I would hope that governments, NGOs, whoever, would see the value in this type of technology and help to make sure that that division amongst folks doesn't happen. Because it is for the betterment of the community. And that may be naive from my perspective, but I can be optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're seeing, you're seeing in Africa even, that through technology, people can get access to markets. And
yes.
So, before, they didn't know what the price is, and they didn't know there was lots of middlemen between the farmer and the ultimate market. And now there are the tools that are emerging so that people can actually understand what the price is of what they can get on their field, and they can make more informed decisions about when and where and how to sell their products. And so, that in and of itself is just going to drive adoption really quickly, because it'll pay for itself in a very, very short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder does anybody else have questions out here at all? I think that's all I had. Yeah.
I wanted to hear more about how technology can help us reduce greenhouse gas emissions from farming. If you have anything else you want to add about the next
Sure. Yeah. It's critical to being able to reduce it, because you have to know what the practices are, and you have to be able to measure it. And we can't do that without having that on-farm data. And so, you know, when we can, the more specific you can get with the data, the better you can measure the reduction, and the more that farmer can get out of value for that. So, for example, in the greenhouse gas world, emissions factors are at three levels. There's a tier one, tier two, and tier three. Tier one level is basically an international standard. It's 10%. 10% of all nitrous oxide goes up in the atmosphere. So it doesn't help you a whole lot at all. You move to a tier two model, and that gets down to a country or to a subnational government level. And so now you can know that in Illinois, if I do A, B, and C, I can reduce the nitrous oxide that I generate by this amount. And and that way you can then monetize that and provide value. You can go even a step further in what they call a tier three, which is a biogeochemical model. This is a model with lots of inputs, lots of outputs, and you can get very specific down to the field level and really measure that benefit. The challenge is when you get down to that level, it is a lot of data, it is a lot of time. These models take hours to run still. And so, you know, you get, the question is between that tier two and tier three, where do you get the largest benefit? And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. We're actively trying to figure out, okay, how can we minimize the data input, the time, and the cost to be able to maximize the environmental benefit and therefore the revenue to the farmer, because the markets will pay for that.
Meaning a carbon market.
Yeah, a carbon market. But you could also look at it from a supply chain market as well. Is that if you can maximize your output, maximize your environmental benefit, then you can get to a higher tier of recognition within the supply chain. So when we look at things within the Walmart supply chain, we have tiers of how good are you doing? How good is your feedback system? I was sitting at lunch, and people were talking about areas of the country where they've had nutrient management plans for a long, long time. The nutrient management plan is a binder on the shelf that has an inch thick of dust on it. When you get to the point of you've got a feedback system that can give you intra-season feedback on when and where and how to apply fertilizer, now you've got something that really is specific to your field, specific to your weather, specific to your soil, that's really going to help you not only maximize yield, but minimize the environmental impact.
But I'm not talking about greenhouse gases.
But that would, a nutrient management plan would maximize the fertilizer that goes into the plant and minimize what goes into the water and out to the air. So I think of it going, I think of fertilizer going four places, in, up, down, or out. It can go into the plant, down in the soil, up into the air, out into the water. If we can maximize what goes into the plant and down in the soil, then we've got success, because we've minimized what goes up into the air and out into the water. And that's really what we're trying to do. So I always look at it as, how do we get the best plant health and the best soil health that we can? And when you do that, you naturally you minimize what goes in the other two places.
Awesome. Anything else? These guys will be around for a little bit afterwards, so if you have any questions, follow up. Well, I think that's it. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. I thought that was great.
Thank you.
And thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you.